pa'o'uli, which was a small Hawaiian forest bird, the only individual of the species. It was the last individual of an entire species. Probably the only time in the history of this planet where humankind was in possession of the last individual. Our hope was to find the other one.
To have a condor out there pass by your environment, casting a shadow, you can actually hear the primaries in the wind. It's one of the most impressive things you're going to view in nature.
Good morning, I'm Tommy Halm, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International, broadcast from the studios of KBZT, FM 94.9 in San Diego. Tree Huggers International is a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program dedicated to the preservation of parks, wilderness, and special places. From the beaches, to the mountains, to the deserts. This is Tree Huggers International. Be careful, and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. With more than 6.8 billion people on the planet today competing for resources, trying to save endangered species can be a very tall order. But through partnerships and collaborations and cooperation and financial support from friends, members, and foundations, the San Diego Zoo is making a significant difference for the plants and animals which share our planet. The zoo recently released a list of 10 conservation success stories involving elephants and frogs, gorillas and kangaroo rats, and pandas, which are pretty iconic when it comes to the San Diego Zoo. And this list should make everyone in the conservation community not only proud, but hopeful. While all 10 of these conservation success stories merit attention, and you can find a link to the story at the Tree Huggers International website, I wanted to focus today on two of those stories, both involving birds. One, a specific bird which many people mistakenly believe is native only to California, and two, conservation efforts regarding a wide variety of birds native to the 50th state, Hawaii. We've talked desert tortoises with the San Diego Zoo before, but today we're sticking with the birds, and I'd like to welcome Alan Lieberman from the Hawaiian Endangered Bird Conservation Program and the San Diego Zoo's Keahu Bird Conservation Center on the Big Island of Hawaii. And also Mike Wallace, a program director scientist with the San Diego Zoo Institute for Conservation Research, who works with the zoo's California Condor Program. Alan, Mike, welcome to Tree Huggers International. It is very nice to have the two of you here today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Great to be here.
I'd like to address this question to both of you, first of all, in part because I promised my nephew I would do so, but is it true that birds really are a living relic of dinosaurs, and are they really the closest creatures around today which are a link to dinosaurs? Is that accurate?
They may have had their start as dinosaurs. That's one of the most potent theories today, is that they're a direct link to the dinosaur lore of the past.
Warm-blooded dinosaurs, I like to think of them. There's one lizard-like creature in New Zealand, the tuatara, which would be the closest link. Most people would never even know that or see one, but it is a living dinosaur, literally. But birds are the, let's say, the supercharged dinosaurs, the ones that have really gone out far on that limb of life, or the tree of life, and have excelled much more significantly than dinosaurs ever did.
Another way to look at it is a lot of the dinosaurs that we know and love, the tyrannosaurs, the raptors, they had feathers too, probably for insulation. But they're finding in the fossil record now that those were actually feathers they're looking at, more for insulation than anything else.
How strange, though.
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah, that's not something you'd think of when it comes to dinosaurs at all.
Well, think of it like this. Feathers are nothing more than modified scales. Mm. Truly, that's if you look at the structure of a feather and the way they're built with keratinized tissue. It's really just a modified scale. And the first birds were flying with scales that had been modified for aerodynamic capabilities. So they were gliders more than anything. And through the evolutionary process, the scales became even more highly adapted and highly refined and became feathers.
It's strange because whenever you see, say, a hummingbird, you know, when I always say, well, that's bird technology being pushed to the fullest. But hummingbirds aren't exactly new either. They've been around for a long time.
Yep. Long time.
That natural technology has existed for quite a long time.
That's right. The closest thing I can think of is look at a bird's legs and feet and the way they're scaled, their structure, much of it is very much like a reptile. So if you just look at the feet and don't consider the rest of it, they're very reptilian in that respect.
Well, let's talk about the Keho Bird Conservation Center in Hawaii, because I think it may surprise some. The San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoological Society is active beyond the borders of California. And there's two bird centers in Hawaii, correct?
That's correct. One in Maui, appropriately named the Maui Bird Conservation Center, and one on the Big Island, which happens to be on the Keho Ranch. So it was named after that ranch. So it's the Keho Bird Conservation Center. It's not too far from Volcano, which is Volcano National Park, is world famous. And a lot of people who go to the Big Island for tourism end up not too far from where the center is located.
So was the Keho Center founded, was it created by the zoo, or was it a matter of the zoo being in a position to take over the research work there?
It's a very interesting history, I think. Two of the staff from the zoo started the center with the Peregrine Fund, and I happened to be one of those two in 1993. My wife and I, Cindy Keeler, and I left the zoo with a lot of technical expertise in how to raise birds from the egg, how to hatch birds and raise them. That expertise was needed in Hawaii to be applied to some of the really highly endangered forest birds. So we left the zoo and started the project with the Peregrine Fund. Small organization that can move very quickly, mobilize resources very quickly, hired us away from the zoo. They're basically a raptor conservation organization. Raptors being falcons, hawks, and eagles. But they went out on a bit of a limb, if I could use that expression, and went to forest birds, which are not raptors. But they realized that they were the only organization in the world that could mobilize that quickly, because it was really a desperate situation. Birds were going extinct year by year in Hawaii. So they recruited us. We started the project. And in 2000, 7 years later, the Peregrine Fund was very satisfied with the progress of the organization, of the program itself, and asked us to take it back to the zoo, take it to the zoo or any other organization that would have a facility that was fully trained, fully funded, fully operational, and had already established a reputation as being a successful conservation project. The zoo was very happy to bring it back, and they knew us, they knew the personalities, and that's personalities with a P, I suppose, I've heard. And we brought it back to the zoo, and that was 10 years ago, and we've done even better since. And one of the reasons we brought it back to the zoo, we felt it was very important to bring the project to the zoo, or the zoo to the project, because the zoo had capabilities and depth that the Peregrine Fund never had and never would have, and they recognized this. Things like pathology, wildlife disease, genetics, veterinary medicine, reproductive physiology, a lot of the research disciplines that the Peregrine Fund did not need for their operations, but we did for ours. For instance, one of the birds that we had in our inventory, our collection, if you will, was the po'o'uli, which was a small Hawaiian forest bird, the only individual of the species. And I need to repeat that because it's a hard concept for some people to understand. It was the last individual of an entire species, and we had it in our collection.
The last one.
Yeah, see, I knew you would repeat that because it's a hard concept. It's probably the only time in the history of this planet where humankind was in possession of the last individual. Our hope was to find the other one, and there was a field crew that did nothing but look for the other bird, never found one. This bird died in our collection. It was 15 years old, never reproduced. But on the day of its death, we took tissues from its eye, and the genetics department at the zoo, we shipped the tissue immediately. It was on Thanksgiving weekend of old weekends. We had it overnighted with FedEx, the tissue, and it was grown into what we call fibroblasts, which are the basic cell of an animal, the genetic material, basically. And it is now alive as a cell line in our frozen zoo. And it's the only extinct animal we have in that frozen zoo, because it's now considered to be extinct. We never found the second or an additional bird. So that's a long story to your question of how did the zoo get involved. But I think it's an important story because it demonstrates the latitude, the depth of conservation as a science that the zoo has in its personnel and in its staff and in its projects and programs. So all these different disciplines are critically important to many conservation programs that you would never think would need a genetics component or a veterinary component or a pathology component. These are really important disciplines that support and make the success. It gets us to the next level.
What was it that reduced this species down to one? I mean, and I guess that's part of a larger question of what are some of the major threats to birds in Hawaii in general?
Right. Well, I think the pōuli is the, let's say, the model for what can go wrong. If you want to, the poor bird is being used as the example, the bad boy example. But the fact is, it was only discovered in 1973. So you already know that it was an incredibly small population in a very restricted area on Maui, East Maui, in the Hana Forest, which was not a very large forest. I think it has something like 5,000 acres, which is not very large. And the entire world population was discovered in that forest. And there probably weren't more than 200 animals to begin with. And it had already been reduced to that small forest, and nobody even knew it existed. So that bird already had serious handicaps for its long-term persistence, I should say. It had everything going against it. It had rats in the forest. It had pigs in the forest. It had cattle in that forest. People were logging that forest. As soon as it was discovered, Fish and Wildlife Service and the state of Hawaii, Division of Forestry and Wildlife, mobilized as much resources as they could in a short order, put fences around that forest, started putting out rat control, reducing the pigs, eventually eliminating the pigs. All the cattle came out. The forest actually started getting healthier and healthier, but I think at that point there were too few birds to maintain the population, and they were too far apart from each other. When we got to Hawaii in 1993, there were only 10 birds known, 10 territories known, and by the time we built the facility and were operational in 1996, there were only 6 birds known, and by the time we were ready to actually bring birds into captivity, there were only 3 birds known. So we caught the first bird, which ultimately died in our facility. The other 2 birds were never seen again. So that's the paradigm of what's gone wrong in Hawaii. Too few birds, too small of a habitat that's been hammered for too many years by too many things that have been introduced into that environment by man.
Logging and grazing being two of them.
Logging, grazing, all these things I've just mentioned were all brought in by man, and man in the broadest sense. The Polynesians brought the pigs and the rats. Mm-hmm. Early explorers from Captain Cook onwards brought in mosquitoes
and malaria
that came with the mosquitoes. So I mean, you can imagine, you know, Hawaii has been called the paradise on earth. In fact, it truly was. There were no mosquitoes, no rats, no rodents of any kind, no diseases of any kind. And when the first Polynesian showed up, it must have been, oh my goodness, we were in Eden. And it stayed that way for many years, many generations. But slowly but surely, all these human impacts really decimated the native flora and the fauna.
Well, because you mentioned New Zealand earlier, and I think New Zealand might have been like that too back in the early days of the Earth, because still in New Zealand, I mean, there aren't snakes, there aren't bears, and that's part because it developed off on its own, it developed by itself. And Hawaii, being in the middle of the Pacific, being a volcanic chain of islands, I'm sure was the same way, and I'm sure you've got very specific problems to those different islands.
Very much so. And in fact, there are quite a few collaborative projects, conservation projects, between DOCARE, which is the New Zealand Division of Conservation and Resource Management, and the Division of Forestry and Wildlife in Hawaii. There are many, many similarities. But again, many of the birds that we know only from the fossil record are no longer there. All the moa, I believe, were all there when the first Maori showed up, and they were basically eaten to extinction because there were large land non-flighted birds. And in Hawaii, too, there are many birds that we know only from the fossil record that were basically flightless, large geese the size of turkeys that were eaten very quickly into extinction by the early Polynesian settlers because they couldn't fly away. There were no land predators in Hawaii. So the birds developed a flightless condition. They could get bigger. You can grow to be larger if you're not flighted. So there were some very large geese, for instance, very large rails that have never been duplicated anywhere on the planet. They're only known from the fossil record.
They had wings, but they couldn't fly.
They had stubby little wings for the most part, yeah. They couldn't fly. They were too heavy. It's not adaptive to be flighted if you don't need to be. A lot of energy.
Well, the Hawaii Endangered Bird Conservation Program did have some luck with another species of birds that also begins with a P. I'm not going to try and pronounce it. I'll leave that to you. But you had some luck reintroducing them to their habitat.
That's right. There are several species that start with P. And actually, the pōuli was one, so we don't talk about that one anymore because there aren't any.
Right.
We have two other species, P birds, if you will, in the program. One is the palila, which is a honeycreeper, and the other is the pu'aiohi, which is the thrush, and that's from Kauai. It also has an English name called the small Kauai thrush, as opposed to the large Kauai
thrush. That's the
thrush
one I was asking about.
Yeah, the Puaiohe. And we started working with that bird in 1996. Had our first wild eggs collected in 96. We collected additional eggs in 97. We bred from them in 98. And we started releasing birds in 99. So you cannot go any faster unless you're doing fruit flies, I suppose, in the lab. And this is a vertebrate. And to produce that many birds that quickly was really quite remarkable, especially since nobody thought we could do it to begin with. And there were a lot of skeptics considering the whole program that it just no way was going to succeed. But I think we really surprised everybody by how quickly we mobilized and got busy making birds. And we've been releasing Puaiohe in Kauai every year without missing even a year since 99. When we started, the estimate of the wild population was no more than 200. So we've already released as many birds back into the environment as we thought were alive when we started the program in 1996.
And these birds are just on Kauai?
Just on Kauai and just in the Alakai Wilderness Preserve, commonly called the Alakai Swamp. It has a little bit more of a interesting name that way. But yeah, only on Kauai and only in this one area.
So is that the rainforest side or the rain shadow side? The rainforest side, okay.
Yeah, very wet. And our birds can be seen if there are people who are interested in going hiking in some beautiful, beautiful countryside. The Alakai Wilderness Preserve is fantastic. Great boardwalks, good hiking, and good birding. Birds you'll never see anywhere but in Kauai. And if you see the Puaiohe there when you visit, the chances are one of those will be ours, one of our releases.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International, broadcast from the studios of KBZT FM 94.9 in San Diego. I'm Tommy Helm, and we're joined in the studio today by two gentlemen from the San Diego Zoo's Institute for Conservation Research. Alan Lieberman from the Hawaiian Endangered Conservation Program and the zoo's Keahu Bird Conservation Center in Hawaii, and also Mike Wallace, a program director scientist who works with the zoo's California Condor Program. And the stories we're talking about with Mike and Alan are just two of the zoo's 10 recent conservation success stories and reasons for hope. And the link for all 10 of those stories is on the Tree Huggers International website at treehuggersintl.com. But if you want to write the zoo link down right now, it is www.sandiegozoo.org/10reasons, and 10 is spelled out T-E-N. sandiegozoo.org/10reasons. And of course, the root website for the San Diego Zoo is sandiegozoo.org. You know, Mike, I want to talk about your work with the California Condor Program. And there was just a story in the Los Angeles Times about, some would say, the state's failure to better regulate lead hunting ammunition. Can you talk about the effect of lead ammunition on condors and why it's so destructive on their numbers?
Well, we brought the California Condor Program, all the species, from the brink of extinction back in the 80s. In 1987, we brought in all birds in the wild, 27 birds, and since then have been breeding them in captivity and building the numbers up to the point, first where we could release them in 1992, and then now we're looking at almost 200 birds in the wild, with a total population of over 350 birds. So we've done very well at saving the species from extinction, but our forte now, our efforts are towards getting it back into the wild and getting it into what habitat is out there that they can use, and there is plenty of habitat for California condors. But our biggest bane, our nemesis, has been lead poisoning from the start. In the loss of the remaining birds in the wild in the early 80s, we learned that lead poisoning was a problem, because we had two or three birds succumb to that when we were first dealing with the birds in the wild and trying to save them. When we got to the point of releasing birds to the wild in 1992 and the first decade or so, we didn't see too much of a problem because our first birds were sticking close to home. They weren't traveling out feeding on their own food because having no parents in the wild, we had to place out food for them, make sure that they could get a leg up in the environment, a start, and a foothold. And so by placing food out and having them learn about the habitat, learning how to, with a little shell game, how to forage on their own, since they had no parents in the wild, we had them feeding close to home. But as they became better, as they became acclimated to the environment, looking around for foraging on their own, they started feeding on dead deer. Deer that were shot or wounded in the legal or illegal hunting seasons that they would feed upon, which is a natural thing for a large scavenger like a condor to do. This is what we want them to do. But as they did, they would go into the wound channel or the opening where the bullet entered or exited, and this would be laced with particles of lead. Or actually in the carcass itself, they would find lead in and swallow it, thinking it's a bone chip or something like that. So we started having our first cases of lead poisoning. And since then, we started on a year-to-year basis catching every bird that we've released to the wild, analyzing its blood, taking a blood sample, checking it with labs, and seeing preserving that individual bird by if it was too high a dose, we could chelate it. This is using a chemical EDTA that we can reduce the blood lead level in the bird and actually re-release it back to the wild. But the other thing is to find out where this lead was coming from. We've been able to check the isotope of this lead. There were comments of folks that were wondering where this lead was coming from as well, saying that possibly it was from lead batteries at dumps. Possibly it was from them picking up lead sinkers or wheel balancing on the sides of roads, you know, chunks of lead. Or lead from the environment, from the old gas days when we had lead in gasoline. We've been able to prove conclusively that it's from this ammunition's maker, this isotope of lead from the condors is from lead being shot into animals. So we had to basically prove that over the years. The first few samples, everyone could say anything. The lead was coming from anywhere. But we've been able to conclusively show that it's from the arms industry. And we need to know this. We need to know, how we can mitigate this issue for condors.
And all hunters have to do is really just clean their kills. If you're in the Los Padres and you wind up shooting a deer, just make sure that you don't leave it out there.
Well, we first thought it was that simple, but actually the best scenario is use alternative bullets. Instead of lead, use copper, which now is on the market. Now, at first it's only been on the market a few years in the ballistics of most shooters use, and perfected to the point where it ballistically is even superior to lead in many ways.
But it's more expensive.
It is more expensive. No one said it was going to be easy to deal with this. The expense is coming down, I'm hearing, these days, too, with better ways of manufacturing.
I believe it's subsidized, isn't it, by the state of California for those that wish to use alternative lead or alternative ammunition? You can buy it with a state refund or state?
There is that program in Arizona.
Arizona.
There actually is a program of you bring in your lead, we'll give you copper. Okay. Or if you want to shoot copper, we'll give it to you. So there's been a program in Arizona that's been mainly educational that they've been pushing to reduce the mortality we're seeing with condors and lead.
Condors almost went extinct in part because of humans.
Purely from humans. Yeah.
So therefore, the argument saying, well, you should just let nature take its course and let the creature go extinct doesn't really hold a lot of water. It doesn't really apply to the condor.
Not at all.
So then the question really is, what function do condors serve in the overall ecosystem, and why are they still valuable to us in the 21st century?
The main answer is we're valuable. They are valuable because we want them. Because as a symbol, as an impressively fantastic animal species to be able to behold in the wild. As far as their role in the ecosystem, they could be called the cleanup crew. We have turkey vultures to do that. To have a condor out there pass by your environment, pass through your sphere of knowing across your path, casting a shadow, you can actually hear the primaries in the wind. It's one of the most impressive things you're going to view in nature.
And that's a devil's advocate question, because it's a terrible thing to ask, you know, what value does a living creature have, does a species have? But that's something that I often wind up hearing asked. And it's often asked of species that, like the condor, are kind of on the brink.
Yeah.
Now, there's a condor release program in Baja.
Yes.
Why is Baja a good location for that? That's the San Pedro de Martir, correct?
That's correct.
And that's a good location because there's just less people there?
It is part of their, well, our edict in the overall recovery is to try and put them back into as much of the landscape as they used to range in prior to their near demise. Baja California was one of the spots that was indicated as having birds up until the 1930s. So from British Columbia in the Pleistocene, we had birds down to Baja all along the California coast. So we thought, wow, wouldn't it be fantastic to have them in the most southern part of their range? And the Sierra San Pedro Martir is pretty fantastic. It goes up to 10,000 feet. It borders on marine ecosystems where they could feed on marine life. There used to be condors there. It's isolated. As you mentioned, there's less people, maybe less, you know, lead poisoning potential as well. So we thought, wow, let's do a little nucleus population down there since we can. And so we got with the Mexicans, and their biologists and folks in the government thought it was a great idea. So we've been down there since 2002. We've been releasing birds, and we've got about 20 of them flying now.
So that's amazing. So there were condors from Baja to British Columbia. So it's not a matter of the San Pedro de Martir replicating California ecosystems. I mean, the condors were there.
That's right.
And yeah, they are there again.
Mm-hmm. California condors in California and in Baja are endangered, full endangered status. Now, when you move to the Grand Canyon, they're actually in a what's called a 10J or experimental population status, which treats them more like a threatened species than the full-blown Endangered Species Act does in California.
Are they released in Arizona, or they just wind up heading east?
No, they were fully released there. When the notion first was kicked around, could we release in the Grand Canyon? Wouldn't that be fantastic? And I was sort of in charge of the release programs back in the 80s. And I said, that would be a nightmare. Look at the convoluted topography, and you really have to tailor the birds as they're being released to the wild, feed them, follow them, keep track of what's going on. And with all of that intricate landscape in the Grand Canyon, I was resisting that to the hilt, until one day I was flying over the Grand Canyon, going back east, and just looking down, confirming in my mind how terrible it would be to release birds there. And I saw these cliffs called, I later found out, the Vermilion Cliffs, which are north of the Grand Canyon. And they're basically 14 miles long of 2,000-foot sheer escarpment. And I said, what is that? As soon as I hit the ground, I called up my colleagues back here in California and said, we've got to go find out what these are. Look at them. And we did. We flew over them 64 town meetings later. In several years, we finally were releasing birds off of Vermilion Cliffs.
See, this is the worst part. Because you've gone all the way out there, and you're on the way back, you've done all this stuff, it's kind of relatively okay, and then you get here and it's like steep.
Yeah, but oh, what is it, a condor?
Holy moly, yes.
It is a condor.
Yes.
It is. Coming towards us. Look.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Whoa, there he is. This is special, guys. This is a... No, look at him.
Oh,
my God. Wow.
There are so many reasons to be discouraged and so many reasons to be pessimistic and to want to give up and to say, let him go extinct and there's not much we can do about this animal or that ecosystem or that habitat. There's always something we can do. And as long as we have the will, there will be a way. And we are going to lose some things along the way, but as long as we can stop the extinction, stop the disappearance, the disintegration of habitats, the destruction of our own, literally our own existence, I think it's absolutely our imperative to do so. The Reasons for Hope gives me reason for hope, and it's the zoo's way of saying, don't give up. We're doing what we can. Help us do what we can, you, the public. We're doing it behind doors that you'll perhaps never see, but know that we're there. We're doing it, and we're in the field doing it. There's every reason to believe that there will be a better day. There's so many good reasons to say tomorrow is going to be much better than it is today, and I think that's true.
We're a society that's used to quick fixes, and a lot of these programs are just not, just doesn't fit that way. It particularly the California condor issue, it just takes time and persistence and consistency. And that's what the zoo's all about, is to develop programs that are going to work for the species. We're in many, many countries just trying to do our best and formulate programs that will do just that.
Alan Lieberman, Mike Wallace from the San Diego Zoo, I really appreciate having the two of you in today. And as usual, whenever I do this show, whenever I host this program, I wind up learning a lot. And obviously, we could talk for about two more hours on this topic. This is really great. Thank you for making time to come in today, and thank you for the work you are continuing to do with the San Diego Zoo. We do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Great for the opportunity. Thanks.
We'll see you next time.
Great.
That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International. Thanks once again to Alan Lieberman and Mike Wallace from the San Diego Zoo. Alan Lieberman from the Hawaiian Endangered Bird Conservation Program and the San Diego Zoo's Keahu Bird Conservation Center on the Big Island of Hawaii. And also thanks to Mike Wallace, a program director scientist with the San Diego Zoo Institute for Conservation Research, and all of his work over the years with the San Diego Zoo's California Condor Program. And the stories we are talking about with Mike and Alan are just two of the zoo's 10 recent conservation success stories and reasons for hope. It is online at the Tree Huggers International website. You can also go to it at sandiegozoo.org/10reasons. And 10 is spelled out, T-E-N. sandiegozoo.org/10reasons. And of course, the root website for the San Diego Zoo is www.sandiegozoo.org. That's sandiegozoo.org. You can hear more of this interview online at the Tree Huggers International website at www.treehuggersintl.com. Thanks also to Yadira Galindo from the San Diego Zoo for her help in making this show possible today. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media. And as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, you can email me at tommy@fm949sd.com. And for more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, go to the Tree Huggers International website at treehuggersintl.com. That's treehuggersintl.com. You can also access the Tree Huggers International page via the FM 94.9 website at www.fm949sd.com. Also, find Tree Huggers International on Twitter and Facebook, and our Twitter address is @TreeHuggersINTL. Tree Huggers International content is now also available on iTunes. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International from the studios of KBZT, FM 94.9 in San Diego. We'll be back same time next Sunday morning with another take on natural science and environmental affairs as we continue our mission to preserve parks, wilderness, and special places on Tree Huggers International. Thanks for making us a part of your Sunday morning, and enjoy the rest of your weekend. Be well. What is it like getting the public involved in these decisions. I mean, the Hawaii Endangered Bird Conservation Program, that's a big coalition of organizations there, including private landowners. And certainly in Arizona and elsewhere, where you're talking with local people about how do they feel about having condors or these endangered birds in their area? Is this a point of civic pride for them?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to.
Sure.
There was a lot of concern. You know, who wants an endangered species in their backyard if they're not ecologist tree huggers or, you know, interested in that sort of thing? That would be the last thing some people would want because of the kinds of restrictions that endangered species bring along. And so we certainly have a lot of federal, state, and other organizations and agencies, you know, Fish and Wildlife Service, BLM, Forest Service, Department of Fish and Game, Game and Fish, depending on what state you're in, and certainly private agencies like the P Fund, the Peregrine Fund that was talked about earlier, as well as other agencies and organizations. But as soon as you get into the public sector, it depends on who you're talking to, whether or not they want to see endangered species there.
Hawaii's a little bit different. And I'm thinking now, why is Hawaii different than let's say, the release areas for condors? But I think what makes Hawaii unique in this sense is that the birds in Hawaii are much more part of the cultural fabric of the state, in that the state is made up of large part of native Hawaiians or partial blood Hawaiians. By far, many more, let's say, native stock than you would find across the range of the California condor. And the bird life, the forest in its entirety and the creatures in it, are much more part of the cultural history of those that are still alive and know their culture, know their background, know their history. I don't know that the condor, other than the, let's say, the native aboriginal groups in California, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, those people still have a connection with the condor, but let's say the white colonials, if we could include ourselves into that mix, don't have that cultural connection. So in Hawaii, it's obligatory. We have a recovery team, for instance, that's formed by the Fish and Wildlife Service that includes the state agency, Forestry and Wildlife. That's the state level. And the recovery team has biologists on it, landowners on it. They also have cultural practitioners on it. So whenever we contemplate what steps to take next for the recovery of any species, we always take the cultural context as part of the decision-making process. And sometimes it can be very contentious because as biologists, we see one way. As bureaucrats, the agencies definitely see it another. They see everything from a regulatory position. I see it as a biologist interested in recovery. And the cultural practitioners see it as a cultural imperative of recovery. They're not that interested in what the regulations say or what the biologists say. They want to know what their many dead ancestors have to say about it, and they confer with their ancestors in some respects. So in Hawaii, I think we're much more incorporated into the community as a process, rather than knowing that many years ago there was a relationship between the birds and the people. Now there definitely is a live relationship between the birds and the people, so you can't turn your back on that.
Yeah, the Chumash Indians in California had a lot to say about the condors coming into captivity and how things were done in terms of putting them back into the wild. You can imagine these Native Americans were quite skeptical that the federal government was going to be actually take in their way of getting their dead to their ancestors, to the afterlife. The California condor, with its, you know, 9.5-foot wingspan, was going to come into captivity, and they're going to believe in the federal government that they're going to put them back out again. It hadn't been done in history before. And so there was reason for skepticism. And we had people picketing, Native Americans picketing, chaining themselves to the front gate of the LA Zoo, threatening to come in and release the birds, all kinds of things going on when we were first dealing with the birds coming into captivity. But we promised to do the best we could. We estimated at the time in 1987 when they came in, the best we could do would be possibly 5 years of perfect reproduction on the bird's part and everything else falling into place. 5 years we could potentially be doing our first releases, and we did. In 1992 we were able to release two birds back to the wild, the beginning of all the releases we've done.
I remember that.
Yeah.
When those first birds went back into the wild. I mean, what an amazing conservation milestone. It really is.
Yeah, and we weren't fudging it. I mean, the birds were, they met our criteria for being released, you know, with seven of their the genetic lines, offspring being produced in captivity, and only two birds could be spared at that time. Now, at the time, the best way to release them was in a group. So we added two Andean condors to the group of two to get a group of four so they could better socialize, and we released all of these condors to the wild in the Sespe Condor Sanctuary, and then later brought in the Andeans.
I need to give you a postscript to that, and that all those Andeans that were released as surrogates for the California condor to test the waters, in this case, test the air, all those condors, initially males and then females, or vice versa, females then males.
Only females, yeah.
All those birds went to South America. And initially we released the males because the females were needed here in California. So we released the males in Colombia, South America. 2 years later, we released the females, and the males were applauding as this was not really, but emotionally they were applauding the arrival of their female counterparts. And those birds are still now flying free in Colombia and reproducing well there as well.
Mm-hmm. So Andeans have been
it's a complete circuit
used all along as a almost a perfect surrogate for our developing our techniques for California condors, from tags to trapping to release methods. And Alan's been involved with, you know, the Colombia effort of all those birds that we released in California. We shipped them down to Colombia.
The Sespe, what a remarkable area, too.
It's beautiful.
By Ojai. It really is beautiful
there. It's amazing there, yeah.